Wouldn't you like to take a vacation from your bills? Well, you can. With credit card balances at an all-time high and Golden Oak's 5.25% rate, you could be saving thousands of dollars after a simple phone call. Call today and get your cash in as little as 14 days and make no payments for 2 months. Visit GoldenOakLending.com to speak to someone today.
Golden Oak Lending cured my blues.
6.19 APR, FHA, 15-year, 20% equity qualified credit. Additional terms apply. NMLS 114937.
If you have a locked AT&T phone, we're here with Bolt Cutters. T-Mobile will help pay off your locked phone and give you a new 5G phone for free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom.
Via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax and a $10 device connection charge. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement as due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early.
True crime fans will love Crime House True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Every Monday, you'll experience the most notorious true crime cases from that week in history, all linked by a common theme, from serial killers to disappearances to unsolved murders and so much more. Follow and listen to Crime House True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Trump administration has been moving at a lightning pace on a number of different fronts, and here to talk to us about it is Dr. Ali Bustamante, UNO Professor, Department of Economics and Finance, and Director of the Division of Business and Economic Research. Dr. Bustamante, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I want to start out with Doge. This seems to be something that's like a complete revelation to folks that we would have a look-see to see whether or not our federal government, the bureaucracy, is appropriately sized. And I've been really shocked by some of the reaction to just the possibility of looking at that and revealing, I think, the underbelly of the bureaucracy. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, we actually have, you know, congressional oversight committees, you know, that are whose job and responsibility is certainly to look at not just at government spending, but certainly the actual functioning of government agencies. And this has been something that, you know, is ingrained in the Constitution for, you know, Congress to have that ability to oversee the administrative state. That being said, you know, what we're seeing right now is certainly the executive office driving that kind of oversight in a way that we have never seen before.
But doesn't it speak volumes, though, with some of what they've revealed? If there is this level of congressional oversight, what are they actually looking at? And what is that role? Because some of what's being revealed thus far, I think the public is like in complete total shock that this is what we're doing.
Well, you know, I think it's hard to it's hard to make sense to a lot of the noise. As you mentioned, you know, it's been a breakneck speed at you know, in terms of what DOGE and really the administration's executive orders have really that been pushed through over the past few weeks. It's really a remarkable shift in the way that government has been overseen over the past, hundreds of years. But, you know, in terms of the any potential, government spending that's into question, like I said, so much of this has really the administration is ultimately responsible for what agencies ultimately do and how they allocate their money.
It's interesting, though, and I think a lot of folks are kind of surprised that there's this uncertainty whether or not the executive branch of government actually has the authority to enact, like, you know, a RIF or, you know, layoffs and some of the actions that they're actually taking that look like they're headed to court and they're going to be challenged.
Well, you know, I sent for the vantage point of an economist and not a constitutional scholar. But, you know, one of the things that seems to remain clear is that, you know, a lot of the functioning of the federal government is oftentimes more than anything to fund essential operations and oftentimes even fund, state practices. You know, as a former, chief economist for the Department of Labor here in Louisiana, for the Workforce Commission, you know, I know very well that, our agency very much depends dependent on federal funding. And so it really is, you know, again, an interesting point of time that we currently have right now in terms of, you know, bringing into question a lot of federal spending.
A lot of folks are saying that some of these actions actually may serve as kind of a shock to the economy. Is the federal bureaucracy that big?
Well, it's not necessarily the federal bureaucracy that's ultimately experiencing these shocks, but it's really markets. So, you know, there's been, as you mentioned, a lot of executive orders, particularly around tariffs, particularly around, you know, whether funding has been withdrawn, withheld or withdrawn from different, you know, grants or other kind of or agencies or, you know, agency layoffs, as you mentioned. And what this basically ultimately does is, again, it really questions the status quo in terms of, you know, what should markets be expecting next? How will, you know, again, not just, you know, what not just what the next move for the administration will be, but certainly how are businesses, how is the business community, how are, you know, trading partners, how do they respond to all of this, to all of these executive actions? And that's really, I think, something that, you know, the Federal Reserve is looking very closely at. You know, in the context of the Federal Reserve, they've been rather clear that, you know, this certainly creates a lot of economic uncertainty that really makes them think twice about continuing further interest rate cuts.
Interesting, though, that we don't tend to look at government in the same way that we look at business, right, where we're looking to see what our ROI, our return on our investment is going to be, whether or not, you know, there's a high efficiency rating, all of the factors and characteristics of a company that the typical Wall Street crowd would look at.
You know, it's a government certainly has a, you know, very different, you know, motive of operation, certainly, you know, by and large, you know, folks should really think about government as, is, you know, what is it actually ultimately providing in terms of services to citizens. Right. And I think in that regard, you know, there's always the continuing question of, you know, how do you make government serve the interests of people as best as it can? And that's really something that, you know, again, it's not necessarily the motive, the profit motive of most companies. But that being said, you know, it's, you know, whether how the government actually does its work, it is something that is completely impacting the business community and financial markets.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Especially.
Yeah. And so goes the way of tariffs as well, right? So we have embarked upon this, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't know, it looks to me like a tariff warfare at the present time. I don't know who the winner or who the losers are. I suspect it's going to be me as the consumer.
Well, that you're absolutely right about. You know, the number one, the losers for any kind of trade war or you know, or the imposition of tariffs in any way are consumers. You know, when we think about tariffs, you know, they're taxes on imports, right? And so what generally happens is, you know, the producers who are importing goods and services into our country, you know, they pass on those taxes right on the consumers. And oftentimes folks think that, you know, our consumption is just going to shift to domestic firms. But what actually happens more often than not is that these same domestic firms respond to the moment by increasing prices themselves. And so at the end of the day, it's really, the consumer who's ultimately losing out on tariffs.
And that happened. I was speaking with someone yesterday where the aluminum manufacturers and the steel manufacturers in this country immediately jacked up their price on right after the tariffs were put in place.
Absolutely. You know, the tariff, you know, that was recently put in place by the administration of 25% on imports of aluminum and steel, you know, that's something that foreign firms are going to pass on to American producers. But at the same instance, any kind of steel production that's happening in the U.S., you know, they see these price increases on the international level and they, you know, follow up with their own price increases.
How does that influence inflation?
Oh, yeah, wonderful question. You know, when we're thinking about inflation, right, we're thinking about, you know, what's happening with prices and whether it's steel and aluminum today or whether it's, you know, imported goods from other countries. You know, not just the executive orders around tariffs have really, you know, been varied as well, whether you're looking at Canada, Mexico, and also some reciprocal tariffs that the administration is certainly looking into. And all of these things have the potential to really continue to boost up inflation. Again, increasing the cost of living for most folks. You know, when even just today, you know, the latest inflation figures were released, and we see that the three biggest drivers of inflation are still, you know, housing, but additionally, food and gasoline are also driving inflation right now.
When we think about, and I've always been very curious about this trade balance and what it actually means to us, because it seems as though a lot of the remedial measures, some of which we just talked about, whether it's tariffs or otherwise, don't really, it's not necessarily helping us. So before it's all said and done, how important in your mind is that trade balance issue?
You know, when we think about the trade balance, you know, in the ideal circumstance, we would have, you know, a lot more open trade. You know, as I kind of mentioned, you know, the trade balance is something that happens at the, you know, that happens certainly at the accounting side of our fiscal state. And, you know, when we think about something like tariffs, that's money that is coming in terms of revenue to the federal government. Now, you know, who ultimately is paying that kind of that revenue? Unfortunately, the dollar stops at consumers. And that's really where, you know, whether we think about trade, whether we think about just the general state of inflation right now, we're really in a place where consumers are really feeling the pinch.
So when we look at, and this is reported on extensively, there's not a day go by where you don't see the ticker, right, on the national debt. Where are we? Somewhere just north of $36 trillion and growing. I think someone said it was $40 million a minute or something, some crazy number. I can't even quantify what that is. I can't really get my head around what that actually means to us. So you as an economist, if I'm sitting in your economics class, what do you tell me about a $36 trillion debt?
When you look at the, you know, at the national debt, what you're basically looking at is the, you know, the check after a meal, basically, so to speak, which is to say, you know, you're looking at the total that's due for all the spending that's occurred in past fiscal years. And so it doesn't really reflect what's actually being spent at the moment. That's ultimately reflected in treasuries and bonds. Instead, when we look at the national debt, that's really an accrual of all the spending that's happened in past years, past administrations, past generations, in fact. And so much of that debt is constantly paid on an annual basis in the form of interest payments, for the most part, reducing that debt over, you know, trying to attempt to reduce that debt over time. But as you mentioned, you know, when it comes to the federal deficit, when it comes to the national debt, you know, these are things that, you know, markets certainly respond to as well. And so it really, you know, it behooves policymakers to be very mindful about, you know, whether it's a new spending or tax cut, how is that ultimately impacting the debt? Because both of them certainly have the same impact.
Is it safe to say these are borrowed dollars?
It's not necessarily all borrowed dollars per se, but I guess, as I mentioned, you know, it's money that's been spent in the past that ultimately the U.S. government has to decided at one point or another that a certain amount of that spending was going to be issued and was going to be paid for in the form of bonds and treasury notes that would have to be paid back. So a portion of that certainly is borrowed dollars. But again, you know, when that money was borrowed is what really where that national debt is actually coming from.
And not unlike you and I, we buy a car, we finance a car, there's an interest rate that's on there. A lot of people just believe that we print the money so there's really no consequence to us. But that's not true, right?
Well, you know, the consequence is always the value of the international value of the dollar. You know, depending on how secure the international markets ultimately feel that the U.S. dollar is, that's ultimately what's going to where we see the greatest impact of the national debt and the national deficit, whether, you know, people, you know, across the world, whether they want to hold dollars or not, because at the end of the day, you know, if the dollar is strong, that means our purchasing power is strong as consumers as well.
Where does the dollar stand today overall?
Well, actually, right now, the dollar is still actually it's very strong right now. We haven't actually felt a lot of negative impacts, in relation to a lot of the trade, what's happening in the trade markets right now. One of the big reasons why we have such a strong dollar is the fact that we had such a very quick recovery from the pandemic compared to a lot of our lot of countries in Europe and across the world. The fact that we recovered from the pandemic much faster and in a much healthier way really gave us a really strong foundation to have a very strong dollar right now.
When we look at our trade, we went through the years of NAFTA, and then I forgot the acronym that's used after NAFTA, the trade agreement that we have with both Mexico and Canada. It seems as though we have, for a number of years, unwound a lot of those provisions. A lot of what was said was that the power of Mexico, U.S., and Canada as it relates to our trade agreement in the context of the world would make us a lot stronger. Has that proved itself out, or where do we stand with that in your view?
Yeah, you know, the other trade act that thinking about in the earlier 2010s was the UMSCA, not necessarily yes. Rolls off your tongue like NAFTA does, but yes. But in terms of, you know, both of them really play the same purpose, which is by reducing trade barriers and across these three different countries, the aim was, you know, Mexico and the U.S. are large trading partners. You know, Canada is also a very large trading partner. And so by reducing some of those barriers, perhaps it would stimulate some greater production in the U.S. by being able to source some materials at a lower cost internationally. What we've seen in the aggregate is that, these trade agreements have largely, fueled economic growth. However, it's been certainly at the cost of offshoring some industries and some occupations. But in return, the idea is that by offshoring some of those industries, it's made the overall U.S. economy more resilient.
Yeah. Let me, if you don't mind, I'll go to the text line. A number of folks are asking questions. Won't tariffs on foreign goods boost the demand for American-made goods?
You know, and that's really, again, that's the hope. However, as I kind of mentioned a bit earlier, you know, when international goods become more expensive, even domestic firms see that as an opportunity to raise costs. And so traditionally, domestic firms do not sit idly, as the cheaper good. Instead, they actually see that market conditions have changed, and they really they respond by increasing markups and therefore, leading to consumers to pay overall a higher price, whether they're buying a domestic good or international good.
Another texter asked about the elasticity and or inelasticity of supply and demand on tariff products.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, think about, imposing a 25% tariff on aluminum and steel. You know, there's a lot of industries that would find, the consumption of the consumption of aluminum and steel very inelastic, whether you're talking about car manufacturing, whether you're talking about, John Deere, you name it, Ford. These are companies that are heavily reliant on these kinds of goods. For them, the price is, if it increases, it's something that they have to pay and something they have to pay, pass on to consumers. Now, not all industries will be impacted the same by tariffs. Wherever the tariffs are highest and most targeted, that's where we're going to feel the greatest hurt in terms of businesses feeling those inelasticities in their supply chains.
And as you pointed out, the auto manufacturers and John Deere's and alike, they really don't have any place to go, right?
That's right. The U.S. Manufacturing of steel and aluminum is relatively small compared to, Germany's and Japan's. And so, in China's to a certain extent as well. And so it's really about, the level of international competition right now is so high and certainly very ingrained into the way that businesses ultimately do their production.
Right. Dr. Bustamante, thank you so much for joining us today. Truly appreciate your time and your insight trying to make these very complex issues as simplistic as possible. Not always easy, right?
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great week. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870. When we come back, we'll talk about the flu outbreak, the highest in 15 years. Try to find out why. When we return, stay with us.